The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the Upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
I was on a trip to Eleuthera in the Bahamas some years ago, and in between the mission work that we were doing, the team was learning to weave these little bracelets from rope, from string. And as they did it, some of them put them on their wrists, some of them put them on their ankles. And when the young ladies were putting them on their ankles, one of the locals said, you have to be really careful about where you put that little anklet. If you put it on your left ankle, it means that you're in a committed relationship. But if you put it on your right ankle, that means you're available. And the girls didn't know that. They were just like, I was just enjoying it on my ankle. No, this culture, in this setting, in this place, there's a right place to put it and a wrong place to put it. I want you to be thinking in that kind of idea, that a particular people in a particular time in a particular culture have particular ways to think about things. Because we're going to be in Exodus chapter 34, and we're talking about people in a particular setting, in a particular place, and before we are even able to make any application for ourselves, we have to understand what's going on with them. What's going on with the children of Israel that we encounter here in Exodus chapter 34? That's what we need to pay attention to when we're reading a narrative. What really happened in the lives of real people at a particular time and a particular place. We're in Exodus 34. If you've been with us, you know we've been traveling through the book of Exodus. The children of Israel were delivered. They're now free. They're following a cloud by a pillar of cloud by night and a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. The Lord is leading them. He has taken them through the Red Sea. They've crossed. They've come to Mount Sinai. God gave them instructions, and it didn't go really well. There was that problem with the golden calf. And now Moses is going back up the mountain to see where things stand with the people and with the Lord. And so we're in Exodus chapter 34. What I want to do is I want to read through Exodus 34 with you, taking steps at a time as we go through the text, making sure that we understand what's going on in the passage, and then take a step back and ask, so what's the big idea here? What is it that we need to grasp as that's going on as described in Exodus 34? And after doing that, then we can ask a question, is there something for us to see about our lives based on what we see in the 34th chapter of Exodus. So, Exodus 34. You need a copy of the scriptures. You need it open because we're going to dip in and read and talk and dip in and read and talk and dip in and read and talk. So I'm going to start in chapter 34, verses 1 and following. Then the Lord said to Moses, cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Be ready in the morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you. Let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite that mountain. So Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first, and he rose early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and he took in his hand two tablets of stone. So what's going on here? Apparently, God is inviting Moses, come on up, we're going to replace those tablets that you broke. That is, if you might remember, when Moses came down the mountain and the children of Israel were surrounding this golden calf that they had made, Moses threw the first two tablets to the ground and broke them. And now God is inviting Moses to come back, and he is going to replace those two tablets. Notice, it's a replacement of the two tablets, it's not something new. It's not a new covenant, it's not a new agreement, it's in fact an extension of what's already been going on. He says, come up, I'm going to meet with you, and we're going to replace those two tablets. So let's pick up from there in chapter 34, verse 5. Then the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with Moses there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. And Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. And he said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. Now, what is the Lord doing here when it says that he's passing by Moses, descending in the cloud and passing by Moses? Back in chapter 33, Moses said, if I have found favor in your sight, let me see your glory. And God says, this is what I will do. I will, in fact, pass by you and make my glory known to you. This is anchored in Moses' request, having found favor or found grace before the Lord. He wants to see something of God's glory. Now, God says, I'm going to declare my name before you. Now, you notice in the English text, you'll see the word L-O-R-D, all in capital letters. Wherever you see that in the English text, that's actually the name of God. The Jewish people, in a desire to honor God, would not pronounce his personal name aloud. His personal name is probably, in English, Yahweh. 6,880 times in the Old Testament, God is addressed by or speaks of his personal name. Out of reverence, the Jews would substitute the word master in place of the name of God. And English translations pick up on that habit, and they present to us the word Lord in place of the name of God. You'll see it all capital letters, L-O-R-D. So here, God comes before him, and he says, I'm Yahweh, Yahweh, your God, the Lord, the God, your God. And when we think about him pronouncing his name, declaring his name, it's not simply he's repeating his title Yahweh. He's going to tell us something about what it means for him to be this God that they know by name. So he intends to reveal his glory to Moses by telling Moses something about himself. So in passing before Moses, he announces his name, Yahweh, and then he calls attention to something about himself. We see in verses 5 through 7, he doesn't call attention to the plagues. Hey, you want to understand my glory? Don't you remember what happened in the plagues and how I showed off to the Egyptian gods? He doesn't call attention to the crossing of the Red Sea and the parting of the water and the drowning of the Egyptian armies. He doesn't call attention even to Moses' encounter with God at the burning bush. God is saying to Moses, if you want to see my glory, then you need to know something about my character. You need to know something about who I am and how I see myself. And that's what he does here. He pronounces this about himself. He says, Yahweh, Yahweh, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, and keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. What does God want Moses to know about his glory? The first thing he says is, he's merciful and gracious. Some translations run to that. It's compassionate and gracious. He responds to people. He's responding to the nation. He's responding to Moses out of his own mercy and grace. This is the first time mercy is mentioned in the Old Testament. God says, I'm merciful, I'm compassionate. That word for gracious, it's a free gift bestowed freely by God. So he says, you want to understand my glory, Moses? Here's what you need to understand. I'm responding out of my own mercy, out of my own graciousness. And then he says he's slow to anger. What does that mean? Well, sometimes I think we think about God the way that we think about ourselves, that we get angry, God gets angry. Don't think about it that way. God's anger is his settled disposition to oppose anything that's raised against his glory. But notice what he says, he's slow to anger, meaning he doesn't just, what's the word? He doesn't strike out on a whim. He doesn't just get provoked to do something. He is thoughtful. He's slow to express what would be called his just wrath. But then he says he is abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And that word there for steadfast love, it's found in the King James Version as loving kindness. It is a single word, steadfast love. It's actually a single word in Hebrew. It says his intention to be lovingly committed to the covenant relationship that he has established with his people. That's what the word means. His steadfast loving kindness is his faithfulness to be all that he promised to be in relationship with them. And then, so then ESV renders it, he is abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. But steadfast love does suggest this idea of faithfulness already in that word. So when it says faithfulness, the emphasis of that word is more about truth. It's not simply about his faithfulness. It is about his willingness, his intention of being true to his word. So he says that he is, what overflows from him, he overflows with loving kindness, faithful, loving commitment to his people, and being true to everything he has said to them. And he keeps this steadfast love, he says, forever. It's an enduring steadfastness in his loving kindness. And he ends by saying, and he forgives iniquity, transgressions, and sin. It's interesting, he uses three different words to talk about offenses before God. Iniquities, transgressions, and sin. He's, in a sense, God is gathering from the Hebrew language all the three words that would be used to talk about any kind of offense before God, and he says, I forgive all of that. All of that. He says, this is the kind of God that I am. All kinds of offenses are forgiven. He does follow it up then with this interesting statement, but he's not going to, who will by no means clear the guilty. That expression, clear the guilty, actually means to let him go free. And what is it that God is saying there? I think what God is clarifying is that forgiveness is not God's unwillingness to deal with sin. It's not that he's capricious in dealing with sin. Sin doesn't really matter. Those to whom he does not extend grace and compassion will, in fact, face the consequences of their offense. They will face the consequences of their sin. And so God is telling Moses, this is what I'm like. This is what my character is like. Did you notice in verse 8 what Moses' response is? He falls on his face and he worships. When you see God rightly, Moses' response is what the right response is. As God reveals himself to Moses, Moses' response is to worship. In verse 8, Moses quickly bowed his head towards the earth and worshiped. And then he says this interesting thing. He says, verse 9, and now if I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sins, and take us for your inheritance. Now, if you're reading carefully, you'll notice that the word there, Lord, is different. It's not all caps. He's actually using the word for master. Having heard what God has said about himself, about abounding in loving kindness and forgiving sin, Moses, hearing that, although he's on a first-name basis with God and could rightly refer to him as Yahweh, he goes, oh no, now Master, having heard that, would you extend to us forgiveness and make us your own possession? He worships and invites, in a sense, the living God to do what the living God promises he will be like. But refers to him as Master. You're in charge, so Master, would you be this kind of God to us? And that's what Moses is asking of God, having seen his glory. Well, look at verse 10. Now something happens and God speaks. Verse 10, and God said, behold, I am making a covenant before all your people. I will do marvels such as not have been created in all the earth or in any nation. And all the people among you shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Here's the thing you need to note. This is God making, reaffirming the covenant. This is God vowing to do things. He is not negotiating with Israel. He is anchoring what he's doing in his character and says, this is what I'm going to do. Whatever you think about this covenant, this is what God is, in a sense, unconditionally vowing to do. Look in verses 11 through 17. We've observed, notice what he says, observe what I command you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Take care lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest it become a snare in your midst. You shall tear down their altars and break their pillars and cut down their asherim, for you shall worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, you eat of his sacrifice, and you take their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. You shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal. So God is unconditionally promising, I'm going to do this. I'm going to drive the people out of the land that I'm taking you to. And what's included in that is then a call to the people to live in that, live there, right? When he says, observe this, he doesn't use the word obey. That word there doesn't mean obey the rules I'm giving you. He says, look at what I'm doing. Observe what I'm promising to do. And then live there. What will that mean? That'll mean, hey, no compromise with other gods because I'm the God who's covenanted with you. You tear down those altars because there's only one altar to be built. There's the altar to me. He's inviting the people, in a sense, to live into the covenant promise that he is bringing them into. It's a call to not settle for something else other than the covenant he's offering them. It's a call to live there, live this way, because, he says, I'm a jealous God. And I know we might think about jealousy as a bad thing. If you're jealous, it's probably a bad thing, or could be. If God is jealous, it's not a bad thing, because God's jealousy is, I want you only for me. I want your attention all on me. And the reason why it's a good thing for God to be a jealous God is because he's the best thing in the universe. And it would be right for his people to think of him as the best thing in the universe. Hence, he's justly jealous. I want you to have nothing else that competes with me because I am the very best thing for you. And so he says, as you go into the land, then just live as if I am really the very best thing for you. Verse 18, you shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you at the time appointed in the month Abib. For in the month Abib you came out of Egypt. What's he reminding them of? This is the defining feast. You're going to celebrate this feast every year. Why? To remember, I, on my own, unconditionally, graciously rescued you from your slavery in Egypt. The feast reminds them of how God unilaterally delivered them, all by his doing, all by grace. And then, looking verses 19 and following, all that opened the womb are mine, all your male livestock, the firstborn of cow and sheep, the firstborn of a donkey, you shall redeem with a lamb, or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck, and the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. In plowing time and in harvest you shall rest. You shall observe the feast of weeks, the first fruits of wheat harvest, and the feast of ingathering at the year's end. 3 times in the year shall all your males appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. For I will cast out nations before you and enlarge your borders. No one shall covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God 3 times in the year. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the sacrifice of the feast of Passover remain until morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. What is he underscoring here? He's underscoring that you belong to me. I've purchased you. You belong to me. And the marker of that is the firstborn of every animal, the firstborn of your children. Those are indicators, reminders that you as a people belong to me. And then he says, 3 times a year you're going to come, if you're going to come back to Jerusalem. Once you move into the land, you're going to come back to Jerusalem. The feast of Passover, the feast of first fruits, and the feast of ingathering. And notice what he says, when you come back to Jerusalem, I'm going to so watch over your property that no one will covet the land that you've left behind. He says, you're going to keep the Sabbaths. That is, work 6 days, and on the seventh you don't work. That's a struggle for people who have grown up under slavery, but what is God reminding them of? I am taking care of you. This is, in a sense, a unilateral covenant. I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to take care of you. You just live in reminders of that, whether it's the Feast of Passover, the regular Sabbaths. 3 times a year, you're going to come back to the place that he sets his name, and you don't even have to worry about anyone taking over your land when you leave it, because I'm the God who is driving out this people before you. I'm the God who is caring for you. I am making this covenant with you. The call to the feast and the Sabbaths are all to be reminders of his provision. Even the annual feast, God's going to protect their land. They can freely gather. In verses 27 and 28, we're told that it took a 40-day journey for Moses to gather all of this and bring it back to the children of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, write these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and Israel. So he's there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate nor drank water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And then pick up in verse 29. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the people of Israel what he was commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face was shining. And Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with him. That's just weird. That's just strange. What's going on there? I can only make a suggestion. When Moses went up to Mount Sinai the first time, the people of Israel didn't know what was going on. When he came down, they were worshiping the calf. There is a question in the minds of the people. Is Moses really connecting with God? Is he really speaking with God? Is he, in fact, really going to be the one that leads us? I wonder if, in fact, this is just a grace gift. When Moses comes down, his face is glowing. Every time he's talking with God, his face is glowing. So when he shows up, what the people conclude, oh, you were with God. You weren't just wasting time. I think that might be what's going on at the close of Exodus 34. Now we walk through the chapter, tried to understand some of what's going on there. And you kind of go, okay, so what? Let me share just a couple of big thoughts. First thought is regarding this idea of covenant. Regarding this covenant, notice it's not a different covenant that was inaugurated earlier at Mount Sinai, but a reassertion of the covenant. It is the initiative of God. It's based on who He is, who He declares Himself to be. The nation is in a covenant relationship with the Lord because of His mercy, His grace, His steadfast love only. That's the grounds for this life. Their call to observe is not their independent negotiating with God, trying to leverage something about their relationship with God, but it in fact is an invitation to unconditional surrender. Just live into this which I've promised. It's not a call to procure the blessings of God, but an invitation to live into what He's promised. I was thinking about this, and at the end of Charles Dickens' story, A Christmas Carol, it speaks of Scrooge this way: he knew how to keep Christmas well. Interesting expression, because Scrooge doesn't make Christmas what it was, but he came to see what Christmas was all about, so he lived in it. He lived as if this was reality. He lived as if it was what defined him. I think that's similar to what God is saying here. Observe everything that I'm telling you and live as if this is the right way to live, as if what I've done, the covenant that I've established, the grace that I've bestowed, my loving kindness, that my character is what defines you. Live that way. You have to think, is God on the verge of finding Himself in other people? No, of course not. Yahweh has already vowed to be Israel's God, that they would be His people, back in Exodus chapter 19. He will never go back on that. In fact, in 2 Kings, when the children of Israel are facing trouble, we're told, but the Lord was gracious to them and had compassion on them and turned to them because of His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and He would not destroy them or cast them from His presence because of who He was. Because He'd made a covenant with them. In Isaiah 54, God is speaking about His people, His relationship with His people, that I think is like a commentary on what's going on here. God says this, "For the mountains may be removed and the hills may shake, but My loving kindness will not be removed from you, and My covenant of peace will not be shaken." You're safe and secure because of who I am, because of the relationship that I brought you into. Because of God's sure and His call to Himself, the covenant can never be finally and completely broken. There are two parties to this covenant, but it's unilaterally established by God. God says, this is what I'm going to do. That being the case, it would require both parties to abandon the covenant for it to be broken or rendered invalid. Israel may not have upheld their part of the covenant, but that does not invalidate the covenant, because it was a covenant God established by His own grace and mercy, and He remains faithful. That's what's being pictured here in Exodus 34. And I wonder, so what are the implications? What does it mean for Moses? It means for Moses he's experiencing God's favor. This is a gift of grace for him to experience it. He gets a taste of God's glory. That's a gift of grace. He is welcomed by God to continue to serve as the mediator between God and the people. But what does it mean for the nation? Thinking about the nation, I think they come to realize that as great as their sin was in making the golden calf, God's mercy and grace and His faithfulness trumps their unfaithfulness. They should not take their sin lightly, because God does not. But they must not take his covenant faithfulness lightly, because God does not. Their obedience does not secure the promises that God made to them, because the promises were anchored in his faithfulness, his certainty, his character. Do you really think that God's intention to make this nation his people, a promise anchored in his sovereign grace, that he's leaving it up to them to complete it? No. No, he is making them his people. It is his intention to do this, and it's anchored in his sovereign grace. Their walking in the call of God does not secure the covenant, but it does enable them to more fully enjoy and experience the promises that God has made in the covenant that he has established with them. Implications for Moses, implications for the nation, and then I want to wrestle with, so what about implications for us this morning? Here we see the implications for the nation. God's not giving up on the nation. God's faithfulness, his loving kindness, his mercy and compassion is what secures the nation. You might think, well, then is there a parallel there to the nation and maybe to the church? Yeah, I think there's a parallel there. But I'd like to make it personal. I want to come all the way around. And what about us personally? Because God is not speaking to individuals here. He's speaking to the nation. So how do we make this transition to us? What I would suggest is the God that we meet in Exodus 34 is, in fact, the God that we meet in the pages of Scripture and in the person of his Son. For those who've been brought into relationship with this God by his doing, by his choice, those who are brought into this relationship with God, we are secure because of his faithfulness. In a sense, we have a similar grounds for relationship with the living God as what's pictured here. So Paul can write to Timothy and says, if we are faithless, he remains faithful because he cannot deny himself. This, friends, should not leave us apathetic about sin when it does arise in our lives. But it should leave us confident in our standing before him in the grace that comes to us through the Son, like the confidence that Israel had in their God. He has not abandoned them. He has not rejected them. As I was thinking about this, my mind ran to some passages in the New Testament. Give me just a minute or two more, and we'll talk a little bit about what Paul has to say. In Romans chapter 3, listen to what Paul writes. He says, we are justified, that is made right before God. We are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be just and justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Oh my goodness, lots of big words here. Justification, propitiation, redemption. What is Paul saying here? He's making reference to, in the Old Testament, God passed over sins. It's not that he pretended sin didn't matter. He did not execute his wrath on previous sins. Why not? Because ultimately, God had a solution to the wrath of his wrath against sin. And the solution of his wrath against sin was a propitiatory sacrifice. That's a word we use all the time, right? You probably tell your kids, you can't propitiate me. Propitiation, that word means, it's only used like a half a dozen times in the New Testament. It means a wrath-absolving sacrifice. God undertakes to resolve the problem of his judgment against sin by solving it himself in the person of the Son, so that when he declares you right before him, when you're made just before him, when you're redeemed out of one life and brought into a new life, there is no wrath left. There is no anger left. It is fully dealt with because God has solved that problem. So he is just in extending forgiveness to you. Because if in fact he merely forgave you, it's okay. It's not a big deal that you sinned. If that's how he dealt with it, then he would not be just, because his wrath would not have been resolved. He would simply have to pretend his anger didn't matter, but his anger does matter. His anger and sin does matter. And that's part of what happened in the cross. It wasn't simply forgiveness was provided for you, but he resolved the problem of his anger against sin by making his son the one who not only bore your sin, but bore the wrath of God against sin. So Paul goes, hey, this is the great good news. He goes on to say in chapter 5, therefore, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through him we have also obtained access by faith into his grace in which we stand. Notice it's not just we enter into this life by grace. How is it that you stand in this life? By grace. How is it that Israel continues to have life with God? Because of his mercy, because of his compassion, because of his loving kindness, because of his steadfastness, because of who he is, they continue to have life with him. Brothers and sisters, if you've come to meet this Jesus, you are so secure because it doesn't depend on your faithfulness, but on his. It doesn't depend on your performance. It depends on his covenant of grace. It doesn't depend on what you do. It depends on what he did. Ephesians chapter 2, we're told, because of his great mercy, you were dead and he made you alive. You were dead and he made you alive. The nation was dead. God set them free. And then, having set them free, was he's going to leave it up to them to walk it out and make it happen? No. Paul can write in Galatians chapter 3, he goes, hey, having begun by the Spirit, something that happened to you by God's grace to transform you, is it now up to you to carry it out to the end? No, that is not, in fact, what the gospel is about. And what we see pictured in Exodus chapter 34 is that picture of the transforming power of God's covenant faithfulness to those who he's called into life with himself. Do you really think that the Lord, having begun this amazing work of grace in you, is now leaving it up to you to perfect it? The answer should be, of course not, but the problem is most of us live as if that's the case. That having been brought into life, now we've screwed up, and so now it's up to us to make up the difference. No, no, it wasn't the case in Exodus. It's not the case in the gospel. Peter can write this, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded. How'd you enter into this life? He caused you to be born again. Where's it going? To a destination that's unalterable because of his grace. Are you going to make it? Yes, because you're being kept by the power of God. God is affirming in Exodus 34, this relationship that you have with me is entirely on me. I will make you my people. I'm inviting you to live into that, because when we don't live into it, we don't experience it in its fullness. But once we've been brought into this life, it's not an iffy thing. It's a sure and certain thing. Come on, band. We're going to reflect on this by sharing the Lord's Supper. When Jesus instituted this, he intended it to help us recall all that he is for us, all that he did for his followers. You need to understand, we don't take this bread and this cup to earn or merit or deserve anything. We do it to recall what he promised. We do it to recall the covenant he established by his blood for the good of those who are his. This week, I have felt out of step with the Lord. I'll just be honest. There are all kinds of challenges during the week. And I've not felt like I've been in step with the Lord. So Exodus 34 has been really helpful for me, because as I was wrestling with that, how do I stand up and teach this on a Sunday morning if I've been out of step with you? Because after all, it's really up to me to make sure that... No, it's not. It is because of his covenant faithfulness that I can stand here and say, I can stand before you in good relationship with the living God because of him, not because of me. Now, you'll notice we're going to pass the elements along. And that's intentional. The intentionality there is this. You didn't do anything to enter into this relationship. You're not doing anything to secure this relationship. This is, in fact, a free gift of grace. So you're being offered the elements to remind you, you're not earning this, you're not deserving this, you're not meriting this, you don't need to come forward. As we sing and the elements are passed, please take the elements in hand, we're going to take together. But by receiving the elements as they're passed, I want you to remember, this is not about what you do, this is about what he's done, what you have received by grace, what comes because of his faithfulness, because of his mercy and compassion, his never-ending steadfast love. That's the reason why we can celebrate together.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.